From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, The Living Universe with Dwayne Elgin. By the way, welcome new affiliates to the very growing list of Coast to Coast members. Now, these are all FMs, and in some of the markets, we've already got an AM there, their sister station. Here they are, KBMV-FM in Birchtree, Missouri. WBYB-FM in Olean, New York, WVTT-FM in Olean, New York, WVOC-FM in Columbia, South Carolina, KNST-FM in Tucson, Arizona, COGO-FM in San Diego, and KFBK-FM in Sacramento. Thanks for joining the Coast to Coast family. 564 strong now in North America. It is for us a world record. Here's what's happening. Some 32,885 people died on the nation's roadways in 2010, a number that, while slightly higher than preliminary figures released in April, shows the downward trend in traffic deaths is coming, now reaching the low levels not seen since 1949. The decline came despite the fact that Americans drove 46 billion miles in 2010. Sending texts while driving, increased 50% last year. And 2 out of 10 drivers say that they sent text messages or emails while behind the wheel, despite a rush by states to ban the practice. Lauren Weinstein with us. He is involved in the internet and knows it well. Lauren, this is kind of dangerous practice to have it up by that percent, 50% increase.
Yeah, well, clearly texting while you're driving is a really poor practice to do in any case. But what's really interesting about these studies is that, as you were noting, there has not been a big increase in accidents, in fatalities. And if distracted driving from cell phones and texting was actually that big a problem in terms of causing accidents with fatalities, you'd expect to see a tremendous increase, given that all this cell phone use and texting is a relatively new phenomenon. So it suggests that what we're really looking at is distracted driving that's always been there as the main cause of these issues. The kid in the back seat who's yelling, playing around with the radio and things like that. It's just that when someone has their cell phone up to their ear or they're looking down, and you don't want to do that again, text messaging, that's real obvious. You can see that from another car. You don't necessarily see all the other things that could be distracting other drivers. So it's bad practice to be doing text messaging, and it's bad practice to be distracted. But on the other hand, we're not seeing the big increase of accidents that would suggest that this is a really big actual problem.
Well, you've been lucky so far. Thanks, Lauren. Dieters who can't stomach the idea of going hungry 7 days a week just got some good news. You might be able to drop more weight if you cut back on carbs just 2 days a week. British researchers found that women who essentially gave up carbs for 2 days and ate normally the rest of the time dropped about 9 pounds on the average, as compared to 5 pounds lost by women who cut back around to 1,500 calories a day. Susan Smith-Jones, author, and of course, is a nutritionist. Susan, why is this the case? Why will people lose weight if they just cut back on carbs for a couple days?
Yeah. Hey, George, good to talk with you.
Thanks.
Know what? I'm normally opposed to diets, but this one, I like it. It has some benefits to it. Let me tell you simply what they did. They took a group of 88 women for 4 months, divided them into three groups. First group was put on the Mediterranean diet, and they were asked to restrict their calories to 1,500 a day. The second group was told to eat normally most of the time, but 2 days of the week they were to cut carbs drastically. I'll tell you how they did that in a moment. And also restrict their calories to 650 on those 2 days. The third group also was asked to cut the carbs 2 days a week, but there was no calorie restriction at all. And at the end of 4 weeks, I love this, the two intermittent dieting groups, you know, that cut carbs 2 days a week, they both lost about 9. The other group that ate 1,500 calories 7 days a week lost about 5. What happens when you cut the carbs is you change the level of hormones in your body of insulin and leptin. And when they cut back, here's what they had to do. They could eat lean protein on those 2 days, healthy fat, but in terms of low carb, they had to skip bread, pasta, root vegetables, like potatoes, and they were allowed one piece of fruit. And see, this is doable for several months, and it's not bad for you. But here are three quick tips to make it even better. George, they didn't specify what days of the week, and I'm going to recommend Monday and Thursday. It's
all right.
Harder on the weekend when you go out, and you want 2 days in between. Secondly, if you add this superfood into your diet and you eat a cup every day, you'll lose an additional 1 to 2 pounds a week, and it sprouts. And I've tested this for 30 years on my clients around the world. George, if you came to my kitchen right now, you'd see 7 different types of sprouts growing. And in my December newsletter on my website, SusanSmithJones.com, I teach you how to grow sprouts. The third tip is you want to add this spice to your diet every day. And, George, it's not your turmeric, although, no, that's good. That's a good
that's
one
close.
To add. But, you know, during the holidays, you eat more sweets, and even year-round, when you add 1/4 teaspoon to 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon, it will help boost your insulin efficiency and help you lose weight. So I described that in my December newsletter.
That's the way to do it, Susan, because I went on the same kind of diet, and I did very, very well with that. Thanks, Susan. Susan's website, by the way, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. NASA's Mars rover Opportunity has found slivers of a bright material that looks very much like gypsum. If confirmed, it would be the biggest signal of water activity yet found on Mars by the mission, which manages to keep on rolling. It's hard to believe, Robert Zubrin, it's been 8 years and this thing's still rolling along, huh?
Yeah, it was only designed to last 60 days, and it's gone 8 years, and the other one lasted 6 years. So this mission has been an over-the-top success. And yes, now they have found, absolute positive proof of standing bodies of liquid water.
That's an exciting thing. Thank you, Robert Zubrin. Now, of course, many of you who have watched television over the years, you know that part of that is the theme from the legendary Dick Van Dyke Show. And Dick Van Dyke, of course, American actor, comedian, writer, producer, with a career spanning 6 decades. In addition, starred in films Bye Bye Birdie, Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and the television series, of course, The Dick Van Dyke Show. And Dick is on the line with us here. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program. By the way, happy birthday next week, right?
Thank you.
That's exciting for you.
And, I'm happy to have held out this long.
You know, you've done it all in your career. I mean, I remember watching you in the movies, on television, and now you're with a group called the Fantastic.
With an X, right.
With the X at the end, and you're singing. That was part of you in that song we just heard, right?
That's exactly right. You know, Maury Amsterdam wrote those words.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, have you always been a singer?
Yeah, always an amateur, though, for the most part. But this little quartet, just three young guys and me, started singing in my living room. And all of a sudden, we're hot. We sang for the president last year, and now we got a big concert coming up this weekend. I can't believe it, but I've got a whole new career.
You've done some singing at Laker games. You've been all over the place. What do you like the best, singing or acting?
I love singing and dancing better than acting. Acting is not my very best thing, George.
Oh, Dick, I got to tell you, though, you're one of the best. You have given us so many years of entertainment. Truly, it's an honor to talk to you. When I'm when I'm back in Los Angeles, we've got to get you back in the studio.
Well, where are you now?
Right now, I'm in your home state of Missouri. I'm in St. Louis right now.
Oh, you're in St. Louis. I was born in West Plains.
Yep.
I'll be a son of a gun.
Well, we'll do that. But anyways, folks would love to see you in the greater Los Angeles area. You're singing this Saturday night at the Hauk Performance Arts Center, aren't you, in Glendora, California?
That's right, at Citrus College. Yeah, we're doing a whole concert for the first time.
All right. Come on out and see Dick Van Dyke. Dick, thank you so much, and let's get you back for more. I'd like to talk with you about your career and everything else. And in addition, Tom Grier's joining us in just a moment. We have uncovered an incredible story thanks to Tom. We'll tell you about it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Back a few months ago, I had Tom Grier on the program, and we were talking about Lyme disease. And I've got to tell you, flooded with emails after that show about people who have come down with Lyme disease, did not know about the symptoms of Lyme disease, and I think we helped a lot of people. Tom worked in the pharmaceutical industry. He contracted Lyme disease as well. But tonight there's a major story coming out of the Mayo Clinic. Let's bring Tom back on the program. Hey, Tom, welcome back.
Oh, hello, George.
So the Mayo Clinic issuing a release today that backs up a lot of things you've been saying on this program.
Well, it's amazing how their new model of multiple sclerosis really fits our model of an infectious agent that might be causing multiple sclerosis or an MS-like condition in some patients.
Now, now, in not every case is an MS person got Lyme disease or vice versa, correct?
No, absolutely not, no. In fact, I would like to see research divide this topic into infectious agents and autoimmune disorder so that we can separate the data. Because I think one of the big confusions right now when we look at multiple sclerosis is we're trying to make a model that fits just one concept of autoimmune disease. And I don't think we can do it. I think we're looking at two separate types of illness here. And I think research will continue better if we separate that data.
But before we get into this Mayo Clinic work, let's go back a little bit and talk about what you talked about back in September about Lyme disease and why so many people called us, because they didn't know about it. What are some of the things we have learned that you have learned about this, Tom?
Well, Lyme disease is an insidious disease. It comes on very slowly and can be mistaken for many other disorders or just simply aging, getting old. And the symptoms are different in almost every patient. It can affect the central nervous system, but it can affect the peripheral nervous system. It can affect the muscles, but it can also affect the heart. It can affect any tissue in the body. You see, what happens when you're first bit by the tick is the bacteria enters your cardiovascular system, and with every pump of the heart, it's circulated throughout your body. But this organism is unique in that it can penetrate the blood vessels very easily. So when it finds a tissue where it can thrive, that's where you're going to have symptoms. Now, in some patients, it might just be their joints that it's targeted in. But in other patients, it might be their joints, their brain, their heart, their liver, their spleen. And so it's hard to explain to some doctors that they're looking at this disease and they're trying to fit it into their way of thinking that it just causes arthritis when it really is causing many, many disorders. So it's misunderstood on every level. It's misunderstood by the physician. It's misunderstood by the patient. And it's really been misunderstood in the medical literature for the last 25 years.
You were diagnosed in 1990 with MS, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And it was Lyme encephalitis as well. How did they treat you, Tom? What did they do for you?
Well, it was really eye-opening. I had a background in working with syphilis, so I had a good background with spirochetal bacteria, but I was totally blindsided by this. It never occurred to me that I had Lyme disease myself, and I ended up in the hospital waiting for a nursing home. I had pressure in my head. I was pretty much close to being legally blind. I had an enlarged heart. I had myocarditis. Just about everything that could be wrong was wrong with me. And the physician had just come back from an international conference on Lyme disease. And she began my treatment according to what she had just learned at this conference, which was 20 days of intravenous IV rocephin or ceftriaxone. But at the end of the 20 days, she said, well, gosh, you should be all better now. And I thought, oh, I've been sick for 2-3 years now. I'm almost completely disabled, and you think I should be better in 20 days. There's something wrong with this picture. And what I learned was physicians really had a poor understanding of the mechanisms of this organism and how to treat it.
All right, now to the – go ahead.
Well, the final story was I had a very good friend who was a family practitioner, and she began treatment for me in earnest, which lasted about 6 months before she moved. So that's what really got me off onto the right track was getting – prolonged antibiotic therapy.
Now,
I can tell you, after 20 days, I was sicker than when I started. I was hallucinating. I had just tremendous pouring out of sweat. I just can't tell you the amount of pain and discomfort that I was in for those 20 days.
All right, but you did get better.
Oh, yes, yes.
So was it worth it for you?
I'll tell you, you know, it's like winning the lottery. I mean, it's better. You get your health back. Unfortunately, most Lyme patients aren't allowed to buy that lottery ticket. They're not allowed to get, you know, 6 months to a year of antibiotics like they might need, like I needed in my case. They're simply not given that opportunity. The current state of medicine says you treat with 2 weeks with a very inexpensive drug called doxycycline, and then you just abandon the patient. And this is bad medicine, and it's bad science.
Give us a capsule of the Mayo Clinic research today.
Well, the research is very interesting. You know, in the past, if we looked at multiple sclerosis, we called it a white matter lesion disease. And that's because we were looking mostly at late-stage multiple sclerosis. And in late stage, we see predominantly on MRIs and on autopsy the lesions in the center portion of the brain in the white matter. And the white matter is that portion of the brain that has more myelin. And what the Mayo Clinic did, and this is some very good work by Dr. Claudia Lucinetti, and she found that the really early stages of multiple sclerosis seem to be starting in the outer layers of the brain, or the cortex. And this is the part of the brain that we use for thinking, our higher mental
right.
functions and so on, and considered the gray matter of the brain. And what they found was that these early lesions were inflammatory in nature, and they involved the meninges, the membrane that surrounds the brain. So this is suggesting that the very earliest stages of multiple sclerosis is an inflammatory disease, and that it's starting on the outside and working its way in. And this actually fits the model of infection that we've been working with.
Now, let me ask you this, Tom. If people take antibiotics, the proper kind, and they're in this 15 to 30% window of MS patients with Lyme disease, can they be cured?
Well, cure is a difficult word when you really can't document a cure until you do an autopsy. This sounds terrible, but it's really true. We don't have any good way of knowing when the end point of treatment should be for each patient and when they're completely cured of an infection that might be trapped in the brain. And so for some patients, you treat for a few weeks and all of their symptoms go away. But then when you take the medication away, they relapse. Other patients are treated for years, and they still seem to continue to have symptoms. Now, what we've been finding, I don't know if people know, but I have an organization that we register people with multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, dementia, and a history of Lyme disease for brain autopsies. And what we're finding is we're finding the organism in the brains of some of these patients that have been treated. So it's a very difficult thing to say how long you treat and if you really truly are cured, because we have found the bacteria in the brains of patients who have died who have been treated according to the current guidelines of treatment.
All right, Tom, when we come back, we're going to talk about Lyme disease, how people contract it, and also what people with MS might be able to tell their doctors right now who might not even be aware of this Mayo study that has just come out. Plus, we'll take phone calls with you when we roll along on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. We shall be right back with this important story before next hour we talk about the living universe. Well, 4,193 new Coast Insider members joining the club in November. Truly a record there. Amazing. And, of course, the renewals just keep rolling in as well by the tens of thousands. But that's very good. So we're on to December now with my goal of 2,000 new Coast Insider members joining the club for less than 25 cents a day. Find out all the benefits you get. Go up to coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, click Coast Insider. And for, again, less than 25 cents a day, you become a member of the club. We'll be back in a moment with phone calls with Tom Grier as we talk about Lyme disease on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Tom Grier. We're talking about Lyme disease and MS this hour. Tom, Lyme disease, you get it from a tick bite?
Yes, absolutely. There's now at least five different ticks that we associate with Lyme disease, and I think we're going to see down the road that more ticks will be associated with Lyme across the world as well. You know, in the beginning, when Lyme disease was first described, just about everything they could get wrong about the disease, they got wrong. But one of the most incredible things they got wrong about this disease was they said it was only caused by the bite of the Ixodes damini tick, which was only found in the Connecticut area, and therefore Lyme disease was restricted to the Northeast United States. But the Ixodes damini tick never existed. Nobody ever did the research. They just said, you know, it was a new tick. It turns out it was the very, very common deer tick, which was found throughout the United States. And so from the very beginning, we were sort of misled about Lyme disease, its incidence, and how it was spread.
Turmeric is used to reduce inflammation, the spice. Would this work on MS patients?
Well, a lot of MS patients have responded and said that they see results, and they see it rather quickly with turmeric. What's interesting is from almost the time that turmeric was first suggested as a treatment for MS, the price of turmeric went sky high. So it's very hard. In fact, a lot of curry compounds stopped using turmeric in it and used, I think it was curcumin. And so we find that as there's a medical need for this, that the price has gone up.
Tom, before we go to calls, if people want to talk to their doctors, they have MS. Doctors might not be aware of this Mayo Clinic study. Is it okay? Is it appropriate to, you know, call the doctor and say, hey, look, there's a study out, just heard it on Coast to Coast. Would you please check into it for me? Is that appropriate?
I think so. And I think the main thing to mention about the study is it's looking at the very earliest stages of MS. And so if the doctor is going to diagnose this in its early stages, this is really a study that they should look at.
All right. To the phones we go. Let's go to first-time caller in Reno, Nevada, one of our great towns. Chris, take it away.
Hello, George. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing.
Sorry about your father. We all lost part of the family when he passed away.
Thank you, Chris.
I've known Mr. Grier's work for years. I've been treating Lyme disease. I'm a doctor and a dentist here, and I've been treating Lyme disease for 25 years. And I'm sure he's familiar with my mentor, Dr. Lida Mattman, a PhD Nobel laureate, who knew of this relationship probably 30 or 40 years ago. And she was mentored by a Gabriel Steiner at Wayne State 100 years ago, who would do autopsies on patients with multiple sclerosis, and those white plaques were indeed infectious disease, infectious components, i.e. spirochetes, which was a causative agent, as we know, for Lyme disease. Tom, you're familiar with that, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've lectured with Lida Mattman several times, and we used to have an inside joke that MS actually stood for many spirochetes.
Hey, that was great. Well, I got interested. I met her about 25 years ago in Detroit, where I'm from, George.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that MS had a mercury component. As a dentist, I was interested in that. And she said, let me show you my research. And she was able to culture these spirochetes. We took 50 MS patients about 25 years ago, and they all cultured spirochetes. And actually, you can take a patient who has MS and has the white plaques in the brain, it's called white scatter, and after you treat them with the appropriate antibiotics and whatever else you'd like to use, those will clear up as the symptoms go away also.
That's amazing.
You mentioned Dr. Gabriel Steiner, and, you know, we still remember Steiner today because he invented the stain, Steiner stain, which we use to stain spirochetes. But everybody has forgotten about his work in multiple sclerosis. And he was a Jewish scientist in Germany at a terrible time and had to migrate to America in 1933. And he lost 20 years of research in that transition because of World War II. But when he came to Ann Arbor, Michigan,
he found exactly what he found in Germany, that MS lesions in humans were often associated with spirochetes, and they looked identical. And in Ann Arbor, Michigan, he determined that they were in the Borrelia family, which is the family of bacteria that causes relapsing fever and Lyme disease.
What kind of antibiotics are they recommending for this?
Well, when you have an infection of the brain, it's very difficult to treat simply because the blood-brain barrier wants to stop antibiotics and other medications entering the brain. So generally, a more fat-soluble antibiotic is better. Now, minocycline enters the brain pretty well. Amoxicillin will, especially if the patient is good about taking hot tubs and saunas, because when we learned when treating syphilis, that hyperthermia combined with penicillin was much more effective at treating tertiary syphilis. But a drug that's available in Mexico is roxerythromycin, and sometimes called Rulid, and it gets into the brain about 20 times better than any antibiotic available in America. And it's indicated in 11 different countries in the world.
All right, next up, let's go to Candace in Lansing, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Candace, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. I'm calling from Michigan. I have heard Michigan mentioned several times tonight during the conversation.
Yes, a wonderful state.
Yes, and in Michigan, Lyme disease is very, very political, George, because tourism is so huge here that they don't like us to be diagnosed with Lyme disease. I've been ill for 22 years. I wasn't diagnosed for 15 of those years and had to go on disability based on depression because they refused to diagnose me with Lyme. And medical people told me it was very political here because of tourism. George, I can't thank you enough. And Tom, I can't thank you enough. This is a serious tragedy. This is, as you know, George, from your emails, this is a huge tragedy for people. My life was almost ruined from it. I got lucky, and I did get the lottery ticket, Tom, and I have been treated. I am getting better, but I'm very interested in the water therapy, the hot water therapy, but I've been reading about it. I did write to you, and I got a nice response, Tom, from someone about the water therapy, but then I'm reading that it has to be 108 degrees or more and that could be dangerous.
Well, let's put it this way. The time and temperature studies for Borrelia burgdorferi is that it cannot survive above 108 for more than 20 minutes. So we can't get the core body temperature up to that. You're right, it's absolutely unsafe. But we can get skin temperatures up to 108 degrees. And we think that a lot of this bacteria is hiding in the skin, it's dormant in the skin. It might even be intracellular in a skin cell called the fibroblast. So the more that we can kill in the skin, the better off you are, because as they die, your immune system starts to kick in and starts to make antibodies again. So it does help, and it reduces the infection load that's in your body. But the other thing is, while you're on antibiotics, if you can get your core temperature up to about 102 degrees, we know that you can get three times more amoxicillin or penicillin into the brain than at normal body temperatures. So that's part of our goal, too.
Tom, did you get interested in this after you came down with Lyme disease, or were you interested prior to?
Well, prior to, I had worked with some patients in syphilis, and so I had a little bit of background, and it was very, very interesting. But when I got Lyme disease and I learned that this was a spirochetal illness, and it just totally blindsided me, and here I had been misdiagnosed for a couple of years with MS. Yeah, that's when I really started cracking down, and I've gone to over 20 international conferences, and I've just continued to keep up with the literature. And the more I learn about this disease, the more I realize that we're just have a thimbleful of information. We haven't even scratched the surface with research yet. And yet we talk about this disease, the medical community talks about this disease as though they know everything. And I think this is a serious mistake.
Now, also, let me get this clear. If people have MS, might they have Lyme disease instead and they're being misdiagnosed like you were? Is that possible?
Yes, absolutely. What I like to tell people is if they have MS and they live in a Lyme endemic area, there's probably
now what does that mean?
Between a 15% and 30% chance that they're going to respond favorably to antibiotics.
All right. Now, what do you mean by Lyme endemic? A tick-ridden place?
Yeah. If you're in the desert, chances are you're in a low-risk area for Lyme disease. But if you're in central Wisconsin, this is a pretty highly infected area. And many parts of the United States are hot spots. Certainly all through the northeast United States, we have hot spots. And if you're in one of these hot spots, it's not coincidental, I don't think, that we see tremendous numbers of multiple sclerosis. And that's part of what I'm doing here in Minnesota is I did a town hall meeting in Twigg, Minnesota, and a lot of people came. And to get people to come, I went door to door and we're talking to people about their illness and such. And it was just unbelievable. It was like the first six people that we talked to all had the same story. Oh, yeah, they thought my husband had Lyme disease, but it turned out to be MS. Oh, and, you know, six stories in a row, just that little cluster, it just tells you that there's something going on. There's a correlation here that we're not connecting with yet.
What about infrared saunas or infrared lamps that you can rub over your arms? Might that work?
Well, yeah, for an isolated area, absolutely any heat that you can get into the body. The thing with infrared is that the idea is you bombard the body for a while, and then you stop and you let the heat go deeper. Then you turn it on again, and you get more heat, and this way you can tolerate it for a longer period of time and get the heat to penetrate deeper into your body. But even if you have a swollen joint, you know, wrap it with a heating pad. If you have access to a hot tub, I think cranking up a hot tub is probably the best.
Let's go to Milwaukee now. Mark's there waiting for us, and he's on Coast to Coast. Hey, Mark. Good evening.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie.
Hi.
And I wish to say condolences to you for the loss of your father.
Thank you, Mark.
And the reason I'm calling is I have a condition which is called, it's quite a long one. It's due to injuries. It's called segmental instability, literally it's due to degenerative disorder causing sudden onset paralysis of lower extremities, meaning I just fall over. My legs will give up. So over the years, I was told that it's quite possibly MS. So I attempted learning about it, and what I have learned is there's a higher preponderance of it occurring around this Milwaukee, Wisconsin area. And I don't know exactly what that means. I mean, it's a cluster. If you were to look at it, as far as the demographics, it seems to be quite high in this area.
Yeah.
What would be your cause of that?
Well, I could only speculate, but, you know, with multiple sclerosis, the white matter lesions or the demyelinations don't just occur in the brain. They can occur up and down the spinal column. Now, if it's occurring at a junction in the lower spinal column where those nerves are shooting down to one or the other leg, you might be interrupting the nerve pathway going to the lower extremities. And then, of course, there's other possibilities. There's peripheral nerve disease and blockages. Did you say that this was partly associated with trauma or an accident?
He is hung up and he's listening to you on his radio.
Okay. Well, my best guess would say is if we were going to look to a connection for a demyelinating disease, that they would have to do an MRI of the spinal column and look for the lesions along the lower part of the spinal column.
All right. Next up, let's go to Janet in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. Hi, Janet.
Hi. There's a lot of pitfalls if you want to get assessed and treated. I've learned a lot here. First of all, it's a total fallacy that you need to see a rash. 95% of people diagnosed with Lyme never see the rash, never see the tick. They can be very tiny. They can bite and burrow. The teeny ones, you never know it. So don't buy that. Also, the tests that insurance companies like to cover have a lot of people falling through the cracks. If your body does not make antibodies well, you could be incredibly infected. And if your body doesn't make the antibodies showing that you're making these soldiers against Lyme, they'll do this cheapo test. You won't have the antibodies, and they'll say you're not sick. So it's much better to get a test that looks for actual pieces of DNA, they call it PCR, of the actual spirochete, you know, the bug itself, rather than looking at whether your body had the ability to make soldiers against it. The other thing I wanted to say is that there's a book by Calvin and Agatha Thrash. When I was in the thick of this, I tried doing the hot tub, hot water thing to kill spirochetes, and their book on hydrotherapy is really good because it tells you how hot is safe for you to get based on your blood pressure and your pulse. And for me, with cardiovascular problems, and I'm a real trooper, I really tried it. My pulse rate went very, very high, and my blood pressure went so low that I couldn't even get out of the bathtub. So that's a great book.
How hot was the water, Janet? You know,
I don't recall, but my oral temperature got up to 102, and I wanted to get higher, but my body simply couldn't do it.
You might have passed out on that one.
Another caveat, George, is that pregnant women, of course, should not be trying to do hyperthermia treatment.
No.
To measure pulse rate is very important.
What's new next after this study? What happens?
Well, the study is very interesting because the real conclusion of the study is that multiple sclerosis is an inflammatory process. It's not a genetic defect. It's not the nerves destroying themselves. It starts with inflammation. It starts in the meninges and in the cortex. And that suggests, if it was Lyme disease, that's exactly the entry point into the brain. The bacteria goes into the blood-brain barrier. It has leaky blood vessels. It leaks into the meninges and then into the cortex. And the other place that we see Lyme disease sort of pop up, and they didn't talk about this or focus on this, but it's called the ependymal lining of the ventricles in the center of the brain. And that's where we see a lot of inflammation in Lyme disease when we see CNS Lyme disease in these autopsies. So I would say to physicians, don't just look at the cortex. Let's also look at the ventricles and the lining of the ventricles called the ependyma.
All right. We're almost out of time here, Tom. Would you give out your website, please?
I don't have a website, but people can email me at donatebrain@gmail.com, and I promise to try and answer every email.
All right. Very good. Thanks again for the information, Tom. You're a lifesaver for a lot of people, and I really appreciate that. All it takes is save one, but you seem to be doing more than that. Up next, we're going to be talking about the living universe right here on Coast to Coast AM. Get ready for this fascinating program. And also, get up to coasttocoastam.com. Make it one of your favorites so it's easy for you just to go to every day. Take a look at one of the stories that Lex has posted on our highlight reel about Mercury, something strange there. We'll be back.